Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Howdy, listeners from coast to coast, the Gulf to Canada, and around the globe. Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Well, first of all, happy Easter, happy Passover, happy spring. Out here, we've had 12-degree weather and scatterings of snow, and of course, a little Wyoming wind. But nonetheless, it's getting to be that time. The days are elongating, and the rapid beat of news, or should I say current event, you can't really call it news, it's all just rather disconcerting, is picking up a rat-a-tat-tat drumbeat drumbeat. Reviewing with you some historical facts over at least the next 2 weeks, beginning today, and perhaps the next three, on what has happened to, shall we say, other outfits, other big empire outfits on the planet Earth over several thousands of years, and drawing the parallels between what we see happening on the planet Earth and in the United States right now might be hugely beneficial. Ties right into that financial and personal and physical preparedness series I brought you. And it ties right into the private property, the attack on private property series I have brought you here over the last 6 or 8 weeks. If you have not listened to those shows, I really urge you to do so. And I'm not trying to get more listeners. To be honest with you, I have a pile of listeners. And more would be great, but this is really for your benefit, and in a way for mine, because I get to review in my mind as I'm bringing you the story, the history, what's happening today. It cements the dots, if you will. It connects them with real big, bold black lines, and I think you'll see what I'm saying as we get into this show. And I'm going to bring you a lesson in why local politics is important. In this case, the state legislature and the executive branch of the state of Wyoming. Because some very disconcerting things have happened in this legislative session. The most disconcerting, the denouement, if you will, of this session, is the vetoes by Governor Gordon of certain bills which kind of make you scratch your head. I mean, he claims to be a conservative. The leader of the Senate, Mr. Summers, and the leader of the House, Mr. Driscoll, claim to be conservatives. And in some cases, all three of them are. But given the history, shall we say, of each of these gentlemen, and given their current acts and lack of acts, one has to wonder. I'll bring you the news, you decide. But, you know, for all of you listening around the country, this is a case in point of a red, red state with a supposedly very conservative government that does a lot of things right, but, you know, there's cracks in the armor. There's, shall we say, some liberal tendencies which I find alarming. Because the drift is wrong. And I think you may be noticing that in your state, wherever you may be, in Georgia. Maybe not so much in Florida. Some places in Texas and around the country. But I'll bring you the news and you decide. And then we're going to have a big rat-a-tat-tat, which will tie right into the main theme of this show, the rise and fall of civilizations. First, let's start with our founder's quote, shall we? And I think apropos to this show and the shows of the last 8 weeks, President George Washington, quote, freedom and property rights are inseparable. You can't have one without the other, unquote. Amen. And as far as our rant story goes, well, you know, this isn't going to be a big rant story. I have a kind of fun one to bring you next week having to do with a neighbor. I think you'll get a chuckle, but it's still kind of developing, if you know what I'm saying. So I don't have a punchline for you, but I'm sure I will. But I've gotten a number of letters from listeners asking how the solar installation is going. I've brought you several rant stories on that. Well, here we are. I think it's 2 weeks now after I brought you that story. Well, at least a week. All these shows kind of blend together when you have this cacophony of news noise out there. But it's now 2 weeks into it. And number one, we searched high and low for quarter-inch studs to go at the ends of these wires. So we finally locate them, we get them ordered, and now, although we were planning this weekend to finally be able to hit the on switch, oh, there's a delay in shipping. Now, why there's a delay, I don't know. They're coming from back east, which might explain part of the problem, but maybe it's the Baltimore Bridge. And while we're talking about the Baltimore Bridge, I'm not going to bring it to you in rat-a-tat-tat. You know what happened there. The Key Bridge in Baltimore was struck by a large commercial container ship. It hit it just right, like exactly the right pylon at exactly the right angle, and it took the whole bridge out. And unfortunately, some people lost their lives, mostly construction crew. Fortunately, they had stopped the traffic because the ship had wired in that they had lost power and control. And it reminds me of an event, I think it was about 3 months ago, where a U.S. Navy warship, I believe a frigate, guided missile frigate, lost control of the ship out in the South China Sea, the Pacific. And the ship kind of steered itself in a huge circle until it eventually plowed into a commercial freighter. Now, look, I'm not a cyber guy, and I'm just a hayseed in Wyoming, but it seems to me that somebody took control of that ship. There was some kind of hack in the communication and control process. And I wonder, and I have some stories on the website for you on therightsideradio.com under both Terror and Rat-a-tat-tat. I wonder if this ship in Baltimore, at exactly the right time, at exactly the right angle, suddenly lost power, twice, by the way, and plowed into this pylon, bringing down this bridge, which, of course, affects the flow of goods and services, affects the economy in all sorts of ways, affects the supply chain, including food delivery, and increases inflation. And, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts will cost, I'm quite sure, billions to replace, not to mention the billions in lost business and supplies that will be affected in the meantime. I mean, the loss of life itself, if there had been a bunch of cars on there, if they hadn't stopped them, this could have been a real catastrophe. And I wonder about the fact this happening, what was it, 2 or 3 days after that horrible terror attack in Moscow. I mean, you know, these are innocent Russians, men, women, children, going to a concert, 140 dead, many more injured. The concert hall, a beautiful building, one of Moscow's pride buildings, if you will, with a burned out roof. And then you couple that with the warnings by the CIA and the State Department to Americans several days before that there was an impending ISIS attack. ISIS was on the loose. Oh, you mean Barry Obama's friends that he armed with arms through Syria and Benghazi? You mean that outfit? The outfit that he didn't take out when his generals told him to in 2012? Oh, that outfit. All these coincidental dots, don't you think? So the bridge happens several days after this terror attack in Moscow, a terror attack that the State Department didn't warn Moscow of, but warned American citizens of by telling them not to go to any concert venues. And did you notice how quickly the United States, along with the scumbags in Ukraine, jumped up and said, oh, it wasn't us, it was ISIS. And we told the Russians, trying to use the warnings to American citizens, but not to the Russian government, as a shield against any accusations. Let me just say that terror is terror, and whoever is behind, pulls the triggers of, enables terror, is a terrorist and should be dealt with as a terrorist. We'll see how the Russian investigation goes, and we'll have to take it with a grain of salt since this is all a big psyops between the various sides over there. But there's an awful lot of dots here, and I can't quite connect them yet. But there's something to think about. We'll be talking about this in the coming weeks, because I think there's, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. And by the way, after my civilizational dialogue in this show, I'm going to have a rest of the story on that for you too, because it's rather eye-opening. And we're going to investigate just a little bit Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s vice presidential pick. I've told you in the past that there's many things I like about RFK, particularly the fact that he hates the deep state, since they've killed a number of his relatives. But there's some things I don't like about him, too. There's some definite progressive tendencies. And now, with his VP pick, which is a gal by the name of Shanahan, who calls herself a progressive and has invested millions of dollars in all sorts of, shall we say, questionable Democratic candidates, including Joe Biden, and who is left of left, I'm completely turned off by that ticket. Let's get started. There's been many studies done by many people who are brilliant, and all of them conclude that a factor of economics, population, and wealth disparity, plus a feeling of hopelessness in terms of economic future, bring about social divisions, which can bring down civilizations. Social declines, they all agree to this. Social declines are inevitable with rising levels of complexity, and social declines inevitably lead to collapse and disintegration of what had previously been a common culture and society into simpler, in a way, but more separate societies. But let's shift our focus to this last slab, if you will, in this tile floor of civilizational collapse. The Greek historian Polybius, this is, you know, thousands of years ago, he blamed the decline of the Hellenistic world, you know, the fall of Troy, etc. We've talked about it, on low fertility rates. What he said was that there were protracted wars and there were deadly epidemics, but when those ingredients to turmoil were removed, people were generally more interested in, you know, show and money and pleasure and leading an idle life rather than marrying and raising children. And those who did have children had no more than one or two, with the express intention, by the way, of leaving them better off than the parents and indulging them in extravagant luxuries. Does this sound familiar right now in the Western world? Yes, it certainly does. Rome, both Greece and Rome, suffered and their civilizations collapsed in part due to these ups and downs and incongruencies in population. In Rome, it got so bad. And by the way, Roman women were known for divorcing, having extramarital affairs, being reluctant to bear children. All this evolved as Rome became more and more prosperous in its heyday. It got so bad that Caesar Augustus actually brought up legislation and got it installed and operating, shall we say, designed to increase the birth rate. Men aged 20 to 60 and women aged 20 to 50 were legally obligated to marry. Widowed or divorced individuals within those relevant age ranges were required to remarry. There were exemptions granted to those who had already had three children, and four children if you were a freed slave. For the political or bureaucratic classes, preference was given to advancement and to getting positions within the government to those with at least three legitimate children. If you didn't follow the rules, there were diminished inheritance rights and a bunch of other taxation and, shall we say, negative forces invoked to make you marry and to make you procreate. There was a Roman poet by the name of Ovid, and he believed, as did Augustus, I might add, that the low birth rates of the original Romans and the Roman elite were exacerbated by freed slaves that had been given Roman citizenship, reproducing at faster rates than the original population, so that the, quote, original stock, unquote, as they called it, was not replacing themselves and leaving the task to foreigners, the task being running the country, making decisions, upholding values, culture, all those types of things. By the way, all these prenatal or these pronatal policies and rules were totally unsuccessful. Roman elites, you know, the original Roman, the original stock, they had access to contraception even back then. This knowledge was lost, this is a side note, to Europe during the Middle Ages and the early modern period, but that's a tale for another day. But Romans could enjoy sexual intercourse without ever having to rear additional children. And people of higher socioeconomic class of the Greco-Roman world were able to control their fertility. Not only that, that ability likely trickled down to the lower classes in both the Greek and the Roman societies. And the results are predictable, right? You're going to have less folks, and you're going to have less of a certain kind or type or caste of folks. What happened is as this fertility rate continued to fall, and people came to the conclusion that it was up to them rather than the gods how many children they had, there were other population imbalances that began to occur. There were high dependency ratios when there's an unequal distribution of wealth between quote-unquote elites and commoners. And all these factors came into play, driven by population, in both the ancient Greece and the ancient Roman empires. Humans also display population cycles, folks. But societies like England and France, Rome, Greece, Egypt during the Greco-Roman times, the Ottoman Empire, various dynasties in China, all the same, this is an inescapable pattern. First, there's political instability and violence. Then there is a peaceful interlude. In that peaceful interlude, the society becomes more prosperous. This decline in fertility rates, population, and the varying mixes, the shift in mixes of the population occurs. And then, internally, rather than external wars, you have periods of instability and periods of internal violence. When a population is approaching its carrying capacity, is not enough to trigger general decline if, this is a really big if, the people remain united and the ruling class strong, but in touch with the people that they rule. In other words, they're ruling for the people and not for themselves. One of the things that occurs as these internal population and demographic shifts occur within a civilization is that there is more folks striving or aspiring to higher positions in the society, you know, doctors and lawyers and whatever, than there are positions open to them. You know, kind of like today where you have all these college degrees out there that can't find a job. I mean, I know lots of young people. They have a college degree, they have a master's degree, hell, some of them have a doctorate degree, and they're out working construction. This is not the first time this has happened, folks. It's happened through history. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal, and obviously I've done a pile of research on this little series of personal financial preparedness I'm bringing you. And in doing so, I looked at a bunch of precious metal dealers. There's a bunch of them out there. Some are very good, but I think one of the very best, BBB, A-plus rated, five-star rated, is Harvard Gold Group. They have a terrific private direct delivery program, your house, your business, your investment accounts. They can help you set up your investment accounts to hold these metals. I negotiated, by the way, a $250 discount on your first order through them, which I think is kind of cool. And they have a lowest price guarantee, whether it's gold or silver, and they will be happy to talk to you about that and how it works. So call them, 844-977-GOLD, or go to their website, harvardgoldgroup.com, and use the code REID, Reed, that's me, to get your $250 discount and some other goodies.
Threads West, An American Saga, is the number one national Amazon and Barnes & Noble best-selling epic saga, recipient of 37 National Literary Awards. Written by rancher Reed Lance Rosenthal and serves in part as the inspiration of the acclaimed 1883 miniseries. The sweeping Threads West epic saga is our American story. Beginning in May 1854, men and women from America and Europe, England, Ireland, Norway, Denmark, Italy, and Prussia, an Oglala Sioux family, a Ute Indian family, a Spanish vaquero chased north by the Texas Rangers, an elderly black couple setting their life sails for the winds of freedom, a renegade you will revile, and an American trapper you'll love. Men and women of uncommon cultures, differing origins, competing ambitions, and their weave of the American cloth in the West. Alexandra Brown, Romantic Shorts, says, Reed Lance Rosenthal has outdone himself. Rosenthal's characters just blew me away. They are as real, if not more so, as most of the people I have ever met. Get it now. Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Kindle, Nook, Audible, or from the publishers, ThreadsWestSeries.com.
When that happens, people get disgruntled, and over time, and this has been borne out in all these examples I've been giving you over thousands of years, there is social unrest, there is violence, and particularly young adults in their 20s are particularly prone to radicalization. What do we see happening today on the streets of America and around the West? Listen, most historical periods of social unrest and civilizational decline, if they lack external triggers, you know, wars and pandemics and climate change and all that, and natural calamities, most of the genocides that you see through history, and you can go back to World War II, you can go back to World War I, you can go back prior to that, you can go back to the mass genocides which have occurred in communist and socialist countries over the last 100 years. But most of those genocides can be readily explained as a result of a built-up youth bulge. In other words, a bunch of unhappy young people who take out unknowingly their fears and their frustrations and their anger in the form of radicalization, which becomes ugly and, in fact, sometimes fatal to that society. All this kind of stuff rips apart the social fabric of a civilization, hastening its decline. Do you remember in previous shows we've talked about China and how they tried to manipulate population, and now how they have 200 to 300 million young men in their 20s and there's no women for them because of they're oppressing quite intentionally the female population over the last several decades? Well, folks, how do you orient 200 to 300 million young men who really can't achieve their social aspirations and certainly can't achieve kind of the natural proclivity to bond and to mate and to marry? That's an angry and huge and powerful population. So what do you do with them? Oh, you fashion them into the sword, their army. And that is exactly what China is doing. And apparently send tens of thousands of them across an open southern border of the United States, all military-age males, unchecked, unvetted. As all these population, fertility, demographic nuances begin to play out and begin to manifest themselves, in many civilizations, in fact in most, there arises a dominant minority, as the archaeologists and historians call it, that forces the majority to obey without meriting that obedience. In other words, they haven't achieved the level to warrant the obedience, so they force the obedience. Oswald Spengler was a German philosopher, and he discussed this transition in a book called The Decline of the West. It's a 1918 volume, if you want to read it. He argues that the ultimate sign a civilization is broken down, not breaking down, but broken down, is when a dominant minority forms a universal state, which, quote, stifles political creativity. And this is a quote from him. First, the dominant minority attempts to hold by force, against all right and reason, a position of inherited privilege which it has ceased to merit. And then the proletariat repays injustice with resentment, fear with hate, and violence with violence when it executes its acts of succession. Yet the whole movement ends in positive acts of creation, and this is on the part of all actors in the tragedy of disintegration. The dominant minority creates a universal state, the internal proletariat in a universal church, and the external proletariat a bevy of barbarian war bands. Now, folks, just think about the barbarian war bands of Black Lives Matter, Antifa, etc. Think about all us bitter clingers, the religion and the guns. And think about the dominant minority, which we see running amok in Washington, D.C., the tyranny of the 3.5%. By the way, when these historians and archaeologists use the word church, what they're talking about is the collective spiritual bond of a common worship, not Lutheran or Catholic or whatever. Much bigger picture than that. Much bigger picture than that. Really, it comes down to, do you believe in God or a higher power, or do you not? That is really the glue of the word church, as all these folks use it. There was a historian by the name of Carol Quigley, and she wrote The Evolution of Civilizations. What he said was societal disintegration involves a metamorphosis, if you will, of social instruments, which are set up to meet actual needs, not the needs of institutions, which serve their own interest. Think about big business. Think about big tech. Think about big government, folks. At the expense of the social needs of the subservient majority. And we've talked about Tony B. and the Clash of Civilizations. The Clash of Civilizations, by the way, was actually a book by a political scientist by the name of Samuel P. Huntington. He thought of human history very broadly. He thought of history as civilizations, and he thought that the world after the end of the Cold War would become a multipolar one of competing major civilizations which were divided by, quote, fault lines, unquote. Boy, is that true or what? Continental divides. Ideological divides. Axis divides. Iran, China, Russia against America and Europe. I mean, this guy kind of had it nailed. By the way, this book was written in 1997, which I think is quite interesting. There's another evolutionary anthropologist, if you will, and historian. His name is Peter Churchin. He thought that there were equations that could be used to model the population of predator and prey in the animal kingdom. And he thought that they could also be used to describe what happens in human societies. Basically, he examined social factors, such as income inequality, just to take one, and how they related to political instability. And what he found in his research was that when you had cycles of unrest in historical societies, ancient Egypt, China, Russia, you name it, it's basically when the population grows, it's back to this population theory again, and the cost of labor drops. So that creates a wealthier upper class, while the life for the working class deteriorates. Does this sound familiar, folks? And then as this inequality grows, the society becomes more and more unstable. The lower class is miserable, and the upper class is entangled in infighting. Exacerbating this kind of social turbulence, if you will, eventually leads to collapse. He pegged these cycles as shorter and longer cycles, and the shorter population cycle, when all this occurred, he pegged it 50 years. And it basically consists of two generations, one peaceful and one turbulent. If you look at United States history, folks, just let's step back here and kind of look back over our shoulders. The times that this country has had serious socio-political instability is 1870, 1920, 1970, and here we are, 2020. Each one of them 50 years apart. Imagine that. By the way, he pointed out that the U.S. is not the only Western nation. In fact, all Western nations are under a similar strain. And this kind of brings us to a little sidelight, which I'm going to cover in depth next week. It's very important that you understand these economic cycles and the waves in which cycles are contained. And this is the Kondratieff wave theory. And now for the rest of the story on civilizational collapse. Really two prongs to this, and we're going to kill several birds with one stone. The first prong is, you know, this growing incidence, and I've brought you a number of stories, on squatters moving into people's houses, I mean literally while they're out shopping, and the folks, particularly in blue states and blue cities, being unable to get rid of them because it's unlawful eviction. Never mind that you're armed with the deed that you pay the mortgage, etc. You can't even turn off the utilities on these people, nor change the locks, or you go to jail for unlawful eviction. Well, now it seems that it's catching on with illegal aliens. Yes, in fact, there's a whole network of illegal aliens on social media telling each other how to become squatters in other people's houses. I have it under Family Safety, rat-a-tat-tat, and under the audio bar. You can watch, listen, and You know, shake your head all by yourself. The second prong of this is, and it's a manifestation of the division, the breakdown of cohesion in American society, is the RFK for president candidacy. He has a lot of followers, folks. Do not discount this guy. First of all, there's a lot of his ideas I happen to like, okay? And I'm pretty much to the right, shall we say. But there's several of his ideas that I abhor that would stop me from voting for him. But the coup de grace on my view of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and not really on him, but on his the planks of his independent party run, is his choice of a VP president by the name of Shanahan. She's a billionaire. She's made all sorts of monies in high tech and in business. She came from a relatively privileged background, as did Kennedy himself, as did Trump, for that matter. But I think her history and her statements tell you what you need to know about her. She spent a lot of time abroad during her college years, including studying intellectual property and Chinese law at the National University of Singapore. She divorced from a guy by the name of Krantz, Jeremy Krantz, who is a very wealthy Bay Area investor. After 2 years of marriage, no kids. She married Sergey Brin, a co-founder of Google. Oh, well, that's our friend. And a billionaire. In 2018, she met him, by the way, at a yoga festival in Lake Tahoe. They have one daughter, Echo, who unfortunately is autistic. They were divorced in 2022. Brin accused her of having an affair with, of all people, Elon Musk. Both Elon Musk and Shanahan deny that affair. Shanahan, by the way, sought over $1 billion from Brin in this divorce. The final settlement of assets is confidential, but I assume it was rather sizable. I think, in her own words, she sums up her mindset best. Quote, I want to get the word out and assure everyone I am committed, as ever, to dedicating my life's work to social justice, climate solutions, and a thoughtful, caring democracy. Unquote. As the rest of the story goes here, folks, because I kind of killed two birds with one stone. I told you why the RFK ticket is totally off my radar. Well, not off my radar. I'm going to keep watching them, but off my even remote potential in terms of pulling a lever for. But more importantly, that third-party candidacy, which, by the way, has a lot of steam. I mean, a lot of steam. Do not discount them. They are probably ahead of where Ross Perot was decades ago. They have every chance, as I brought you, and I don't hear anybody else talking about it, a week or two ago, of throwing this election into the House of Representatives for the first time since 1807. And they are a manifestation of the fracturing of this society, right? You have the progressive communist left, you have the right, you have people in the middle, and then you have the disaffected. And they are going for the disaffected tribe. And they could very well carry, remember, she's from California, all sorts of contacts out there, media, Hollywood, tech, politics, money, you name it. They could carry California, folks. 55 electoral votes. It's going to be an interesting election season. More on Shanahan and the third party run next week. And speaking about elections, and speaking about politics, and speaking about fractions and divisions, even within the same supposed mindset, let's talk a little bit about Wyoming. Let's shift our focus to how important state, local, and county elections are. And case in point, Wyoming, a red, red state, supposedly with a conservative state government. And we have a president of the Senate, Mr. Summers, and a speaker of the House, Mr. Driscoll, and a governor, Mr. Gordon. And by the way, I've met Mark and his wife, the governor, and very nice people. So this isn't about them. This is about policy, and this is about action and inaction. And I'm not going to get into the weeds here. I'm just going to hit it kind of general. So the governor vetoed five bills, pretty critical bills, in my estimation, that came out of the legislature. The legislature had left with 3 days to spare. Nobody asked them to stay, not the Senate president, not the Speaker of the House. And the governor, at least in my opinion, waited until pretty much the last minute, like close to midnight, to veto those bills. And I think it appears that that was done to preclude the legislature from coming back and overriding his veto. And I want to say up front that if any one of these three gentlemen want to come on this show or come on my new YouTube Rumble Substack channel that I'll be gearing up here shortly and tell me why they've done this and give me their reasons, it would be terrific. But right now I only have to go on what they've said and what the news reports. So one of the bills was a bill where the legislature appropriated $75 million for legal fees and other costs to combat the federal government on this nonsense BLM plan down around the Rock Springs area. And it goes right into the private property rights things that we've been discussing here on this show for the last 4 or 5 weeks. And it's the inverted top of the pyramid, right? Get control of the public resources and then compress it down to your front door so they can get control of that. Now, the governor gave reasons for vetoing that bill, saying that it blurred the distinction between the legislative and the executive branches. But, you know, if he was really, really upset about this BLM plan, as he says he is, nothing precludes him from going to the legislature and saying, listen, I know you're working on this bill. You're going to have to do it this way so I don't have to veto it or I can sign it. That is done all the time at every level of government in the United States and, for that matter, probably around the world. There is collaboration between the various branches on legislation. So it's both legal and workable and logical. In the meantime, our Congress lady, Ms. Hageman, is doing a stand-up job of fighting the BLM and is taking the fight right to their front door. Good for her. Then there was a taxpayer bill. It would lower property taxes for a significant portion of the state. I'm not going to get into the weeds on it. There's different arguments on it. It's one time. It's not enough. It's too much. It hurts the budget. It doesn't. But it was overwhelmingly passed by the House and Senate. And then there was a charter school bill, which would provide aid and assistance to charter schools and allow more charter schools to start in the state, as I read the bill. And that was vetoed by the governor pretty much at the last minute. And then there was the gun-free zone bill, which, by the way, the governor pledged in writing to support several years ago when he ran for office, which the governor vetoed. And I know for sure that he was lobbied by Bloomberg and MOMS, which is a anti-gun, or should we say gun control, group. It's not a bill that was particularly favored by either Mr. Summers or Mr. Driscoll, and it was passed with a rather substantial margin, and it's about the third time it's run through the legislature, and it was vetoed. And then there was, and it surprised people on both sides of the issue, the veto of a restriction on abortion rights. And, you know, when I say abortion rights, I use the term rights in quotes. I think privileges is a better word. Now, to the governor's credit, he did sign the bill which limited, quote-unquote, gender-affirming, unquote, care in Wyoming. But that seems incongruous with his veto of the abortion bill, which I haven't seen a good explanation for. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal, and obviously I've done a pile of research on this little series of personal financial preparedness I'm bringing you. And in doing so, I looked at a bunch of precious metal dealers. There's a bunch of them out there. Some are very good, but I think one of the very best, BBB, A-plus rated, 5-star rated, is Harvard Gold Group. They have a terrific private direct delivery program, your house, your business, your investment accounts. They can help you set up your investment accounts to hold these metals. I negotiated, by the way, a $250 discount on your first order through them, which I think is kind of cool. And they have a lowest price guarantee, whether it's gold or silver, and they will be happy to talk to you about that and how it works. So call them, 844-977-GOLD, or go to their website, harvardgoldgroup.com, and use the code REID, Reed, that's me, to get your $250 discount and some other goodies. Hey listeners, this is Reed Lance Rosenthal, your host of On the Right Side Radio, and I have a message for you. Do you want a business? Sell a product? Provide a service? Have a message you want to get out? Do you believe in freedom, the Constitution, and America? Here's your opportunity to reach 69 million sets of ears in scores of markets around the country, including 5 of the top 10 and 15 of the top 50 markets in the United States of America. Very affordable, very flexible, 30 and 60 second packages available. Give your business a boost and help America get the truth. Call Francis at Media Airtime at 602-300-8250, 602-300-8250, or write Francis at MediaAirtime.com. That's FRANCIS at MediaAirtime.com. Thank you. And I've read the governor's explanations in the newspapers, and I've read Mr. Driscoll and Mr. Summers' statements in the newspapers. We'll get to those in just a minute. And, you know, they don't do it for me, to be honest with you. They just don't do it for me. And maybe what we need to have is a discussion so that people can hear what his reasoning was. Maybe it's sound, maybe it's valid, maybe it's legal. Maybe he agrees in concept, but he didn't like the particulars. I don't know. But I do know that at least one of these bills, all of them passed, obviously, both houses, but at least one of these bills passed with a super, super majority, unanimously in one house, and I think all but two votes in the other. In my mind, that means that's the will of the people. That's who the state legislatures represent. That's about as close to a representative republic as you can get other than the election of your town council or county commissioners. And when you have that kind of vote, which indicates overwhelming support by the people of the state, I don't think a bill like that should ever be vetoed. This is not about personal beliefs. This is about what the people want. And in this case, supermajorities on that respective bill and or bills. So I'd be really interested to see what the governor has to say about this. And perhaps we can chat sometime on air so people can hear. As far as Mr. Driscoll and Mr. Summers is concerned, there are plenty of indications over the last several years that they have taken bills which are strongly supported, in some cases, it seems, by a majority of their chamber, and shoved them in their desk drawer and not brought them to the floor. That's flat wrong. That's inexcusable, actually. Bring the bill out, let it be debated, it gets voted up, it gets voted down, you can have your say along with the rest of the legislators, and it can go to the governor and he can sign it, veto it, or let it go into law without a signature. But I was particularly, shall we say, nonplussed at why they refuse to call a special session of the legislature, which many legislators are calling for, to override at least several of the vetoes that the governor issued seemingly last minute. And there was all sorts of reasons. Obviously, they collaborated on it, and in my opinion, I don't know, it seems they might have collaborated with the governor, both on the timing of the vetoes and on the excuse not to call a special session. You know, $35,000 a day costs, $350,000. This isn't a $10.2 billion budget, folks, on bills that were passed, at least in one case, unanimously and all except two votes. And that the rules would have to be suspended. So what? Suspend them. And that the legislature would have no control over which bills are brought back. Well, yes, you do. It's just the bills that were vetoed. And that the lawmakers would have to start from scratch and follow standard legislative process. Gee, I think that goes down to rules last time I checked, which, you know, you can change. And that the legislature needs to be in session to override gubernatorial vetoes, and it would require a two-thirds vote. Well, two-thirds vote's just fine and dandy. That's what it requires. And as far as being in session, that's what you convene a special session. And, you know, if you were worried about being in session or not being in session, I guess you could have held the legislatures over those last 3 days going into the veto process by the governor. But you didn't. And that this would inconvenience the legislatures and their families, because they'd have to spend another 8 to 10 days in the Capitol working on this. Well, you know, that's their job. That's what they were elected to do. And why don't you poll the members, as you say you are doing now, as whether that would bother them or not? I have a feeling the overwhelming majority are going to say, call the session. And then, after this seeming collaboration on what happened, and then the explanation of it, and then why you couldn't have a special session, voiced through the op-ed by Mr. Driscoll and Mr. Summers, then it seems to me they're now backtracking a little bit. Well, maybe we ought to call a special session, but just for the property tax deal, which I also view as a strictly political move. Obviously, the property relief or property tax relief bill is very popular with the people. So you're trying to squeeze one bill in, kind of, you know, divert, distract, and divide. You know, a little bit like that civilizational discourse we had today earlier in the show. No, I think that you need to call your special session. You need to go over the five bills that cause the people the most angst. They need to either override the vetoes or not override the vetoes, in which case the governor's decision stands, and be done with it, and stop the feigned hand-wringing and cloaked excuses as to why it can't or shouldn't be done. The bottom line, gentlemen, is it's my opinion as an outsider that you just don't like these bills, and that at least some of these bills Governor Gordon doesn't like too, and that the three of you worked together to make sure that the veto was late enough that everybody had left, that there are a number of what you term good reasons to not call special session to override the vetoes, and I just don't think it's right. So I'm more than willing to have any one of the three of you or all three of you on the show at any time or on our new channel that'll be popping up, I hope, soon. And you can tell the folks in detail, not just in a paragraph blurb in the local paper, why you think what you think and why you did what you did. In the meantime, call the special session and let's follow the will of the people of the state of Wyoming, whom you work for, who pay your salary. All right, folks, let's see how much rat-a-tat-tat we can get in, shall we? Because, once again, I'm not going to cover it all, but hopefully we will cover some. And, you know, this goes right back to this civilizational divide, which is being purposely fostered. And it goes right back to property rights and financial preparedness. So insurance industry, they're in a panic out in California. Number one, I don't know if you know, but California, unbelievable. California passed a law that if you didn't have a claim, a property insurance carrier could not raise your premium. Oh, okay. Well, you know what the result of that is? They're just not going to cover you at all. There are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of property coverages being canceled in California right now by all sorts of insurance companies, commercial and residential. And you know, the insurance industry operates kind of as experts in risk assessment. That's what they do. And they're basically saying they can no longer take the risk of insuring properties in California cities, or they might become insolvent based on what they assume the risks to be in the future as far as the amount of monetary claims. By the way, what do they know that they aren't telling us? Post-election riots? Civilizational divides? Cities burned down? Interesting. But now, insurance companies pulling out of the market. And by the way, if you own a house or you own a business or a commercial building, you try getting a loan. In fact, your loan documents probably say if you don't have insurance, you're in default of the loan. The loan gets called. I wonder who buys it. It wouldn't be those BlackRock guys, would it? And then kind of in a related story, up there in Canada, you Canadians, I know there's a whole pile of you that listen to me up there. You really, really have to make a change in Ottawa. I mean, your country is just being sucked down the toilet drain by Trudeau and his communist henchmen and his globalist associates. So I brought you the story about the Hate Thought Act. At this writing, I don't know if it's been passed, not passed, or amended. But basically, if you say something or you said something any time, we're talking 10, 15 years ago on social media, that somebody anonymously, who's not even a citizen of Canada, thinks or makes them fearful of being hated by you, you are going to pay a $20,000 immediate fine. You can pay a $50,000 criminal stipend. You can go to jail, etc., etc., etc. You think somebody's trying to stifle dissent up there, kind of like taking the truckers' monies, which, by the way, thank you, the Canadian Supreme Court, they ruled, unfortunately, 2 years after the event, was completely unconstitutional, quote-unquote, actually uncharter up there in Canada. This is Trudy and his henchwitch, his second-in-command, who's worse than he is, freezing the money of donors and truckers in the trucker deal, which, by the way, kind of set the world on fire. And thank you, truckers, once again. And by the way, I sent money to those guys, Trudy. You want to come down and try and freeze my bank accounts? Come on, baby. Do it. And then also in Canada, sorry, Canada, I'm not picking on you today. I got a lot of friends up in Canada, and I love Canada, actually. But Canadian policemen, this is unbelievable. I mean, Trudeau, Trudy, baby, you're doing such a good job, kind of like Barry, baby, has been doing down here. Canadian police are advising people, it's unbelievable, guys, to leave their keys in areas that are more accessible to criminals so that the criminals won't have to break in their houses to steal the keys to steal their car. In other words, a confrontationless way to have cars stolen. Well, isn't that great? Quote, to prevent the possibility of being attacked in your home, leave your fobs at your front door, unquote. That's a recommendation by the Toronto Police Department. Right now, there's one car being stolen every 6 minutes in that country. Every 6 minutes. Like I said, Canada, you need to make some changes. And you need to particularly investigate the infiltration of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, into your legislature, your agencies, and the head cheeses of your government. Because they, like the folks who run the show down here, are traitors to you, as the folks down here are traitors to us. And then we have the Wisconsin House of Representative, Williams or Mick Williams, doesn't really matter what his name is. He decides, even though the Republican majority is now down, I think, to 3 seats, maybe 2, he decides that he's going to resign from Congress. You know, it's the latest thing in the Republican caucus for rhinos to do. He's going to resign 1 week, not just resign, and have the Republican caucus even further handicapped. But he's going to resign 1 week after the deadline to replace him. He, by the way, is one of the very few Republicans who voted against the Mayorkas impeachment. And it seems that after he resigns, 1 week after, so the Republican caucus can't fill his seat with a Republican body so that they can keep their very slim majority, he's going to go to work for an outfit which gets all its money and contracts from, oh yeah, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, who is run by, oh yeah, Mayorkas. I would love to see his bank account. Hopefully somebody will subpoena it or get a FOIA or do whatever they have to do, because I have a feeling that either you're going to see a direct bribe by the Democratic Party or the dark money behind Democratic Party for him to do this, or you're going to see that he's getting paid a salary which is not commensurate with his new position. In other words, they're hiding the bribe. In the meantime, other than his timing, you know, don't let the door hit you in the crack on the way out, buddy. And along those lines, Denver, Colorado, you folks down in Denver listening to me on Mighty KGAB out of Cheyenne, what's going on with your state? Like, really? You know, I had the little story about the Wyoming legislature up here. What's going on with your legislature? What about that moron you have as a mayor in Denver and the moron you have as a governor? Never mind anything else. But Denver currently has, oh, isn't this nice, a newcomer and migrant support program. And it allows people to donate. That's fine. Clothes, cash, contributions, whatever. Which then go to the city's nonprofit partners, you know, NGOs, folks. The same guys who are bringing these folks across the border along with Soros and the cartels to begin with. But in addition to all this nicety, this cloak of civility and logics, this is in addition to taxpayer-funded shelters, right? Migrant families with children can stay up to 6 weeks. Those without children, I assume including Chinese males of military age, will be provided 2 weeks of shelter before being discharged. What do you want to bet they don't get discharged? And the city says, you know, all these newcomers, not illegal aliens, folks, they're newcomers, will need to arrive with a long-term plan. Oh, I bet they have a long-term plan. You bet. Just keep themselves fastened to the government teat at the taxpayers' expense as long as possible. That's their long-term plan. Because Denver has limited resources. Well, wow. You guys in Denver, nothing gets by you. So Denver has a population of around 715,000 folks, and they provided services to nearly 40,000 illegal immigrants. And trust me, folks, I guarantee you that number is higher than 40,000. So far, it's cost the city $42 million. And the Democrat mayor, Mr. Johnston, Mike Johnston, he announced that, don't you worry, because we have the money. I'm going to cut $5 million from the funding of Denver Motor Vehicle Offices, because, you know, you people in Denver, you don't wait in line at all when you go to the MV office to get your license renewed or anything, right? It's like you walk right in. Of course you do. And the Denver Parks and Recreation Department. Well, you guys that don't need parks down there, you got a great view of the mountains. What's interesting is these financial woes are despite a little bit of money from the Department of Homeland Security, oh, Mr. Mayorkas again, and $3.5 million, that was $1.6 million, and $3.5 million from the state of Colorado, which goes back to the legislature and the governor. By the way, the city now admits that it faces a $60 million budget deficit. And Johnston, your mayor down there in Denver, folks, I'm sure you're going to reelect him by a landslide, he has said that, quote, the city to maintain current services that are provided for migrants, taxpayers would have to pay over $100 million. Did you hear what I just said? Taxpayers, that's you folks, will have to pay over $100 million over the next year. Congratulations on those votes down there, guys. You know, it's you got your own little Trudy going there in Denver and at the State House and at the Mayor's Mansion. We're out of time. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Remember, look in the mirror, repeat after me, and repeat it with conviction. I will muster. I will stand. I will not comply. I will never give in. I will never stop fighting. I will join with those in these United States and around the globe who love freedom as I do. And we will win. Oh, yes, we will. Keep the wind at your back. I'll talk to you next week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, go to OnTheRightSideRadio.com. Click on Show Archives, and you'll find all of Reed's shows and a terrific array of informative articles, videos, and reference pages. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of On the Right Side Radio with Reed Lance Rosenthal.